Welcome to another exciting time on podcasts with Blog Talk Radio and The Powerful Patient. I'm Mike. I'm going to play your host today. Robin and I are seated here. And how are you doing, Robin?
Oh, great. It's a miserable day here in Colorado, so we're trying to stay inside and stay warm.
Oh, that is plum terrible. Joyce, are you here too?
Yes, I am. Thanks, Mike. How are you?
We're doing good. You know, if somebody looks at our profile of today's program and we go to looking at all the things about Susie Brain, they're going to declare that she's just as fascinating as my two co-hosts, Robin and Joyce, because she's involved in a lot of things. And so we'd like to welcome Susie to our program. Susie has been an advocate for a number of years for survivors with breast cancer. Susie, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. I feel very privileged to be invited.
Well, it's an honor to have you on with us. I know that that you've been involved with a lot of things over the past dozen years or so. So why don't you tell us how you got involved in advocacy and some of the things that you're doing, and then we'll let you and Robin talk, and then we'll let Joyce talk to you a little bit, okay?
Yes, thank you. Well, I'm sure I got into advocacy like many patients. I was lucky to be treated at a very good clinic. I had excellent care and excellent insurance that I got through my husband, who works at Stanford University. So even though I had a very aggressive type of breast cancer, and I had to have very aggressive chemo to deal with it, because I had what they call HER2-positive breast cancer, which is, before it was kind of a death sentence, but now they have this targeted therapy called Herceptin. Well, it hadn't quite reached the clinic for primary breast cancer, which was my diagnosis, so I had to have what they call dose-dense chemotherapy, which was every 2 weeks. Well, to cut a long story short, I got pretty sick and pretty debilitated, as many people do on chemotherapy regimes. But I did come out the other end, and it probably took me a good year just to kind of get back to what we call the new normal, although whether I'm ever at the new normal, I'm not sure. But I wanted to support other breast cancer patients who, you know, were on a similar journey. So I trained with a local organization that offered breast cancer support, and I ended up being one of their helpline volunteers. And it was a way for me to give back, and I really, it opened my eyes to the inequities of the system. I realized that not everyone got the care and the treatment that I got in a timely manner. And some people, depending on their insurance or lack of insurance, you know, didn't get the care that they should have, or they had to wait longer, or, you know, they had other issues going on in their life, or they couldn't drive, you know, just so many issues, as you know, that patients face. And so it really galvanized my feelings that, you know, thinking, well, I'm lucky I got through this. I'm able to help other women, but I felt I wanted to do more. So in the breast cancer community, we have lots of opportunities for training to be an advocate. And one of them is called the Project Lead Institute, and it's a 5-day training program where you learn about the science of cancer, epidemiology, genomics, statistics, you name it. It's very intensive. But it also gives us training on how we can help support the research community. Because in the breast cancer arena, many of the grant mechanisms require that there is an advocate on the proposal. And I think many of you are familiar with the Department of Defense program. that has a grant, office grant funding, and they, on many of their mechanisms, demand that there is a consumer advocate, as they call it, on the proposal. So to be able to do the grant reviewing, you need to have some understanding of the science and what the issues are for patients in general. So doing the trainings, trying to get to as many conferences as I could. They offer scholarships. And, of course, one that, Mike, you're familiar with, the AACR's Scientist Survivor Program. Just trying to get as much training as possible so that you can, benefit other people as they go through their journey. So that's kind of how I got into it. And I surprised myself because my background is actually the environment. I have a degree in biology, and I'd been sort of executive director of a small nonprofit. But I couldn't continue my work because I had terrible chemo brain, so I was pretty debilitated. So that's when I slowly got into advocacy, and I've been there ever since, and I'm really passionate about it, and I'm probably involved in what I think are the three main arms of advocacy. I do research advocacy with scientists at Stanford and UCSF. I do patient advocacy with the American Cancer Society and Living Beyond Breast Cancer. And then I also do legislative or policy advocacy with the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network. So I guess I'm quite busy.
But you're quite busy.
Yes.
But one thing I'd like to ask you about, I know a lot of people are curious about why on earth is the Department of Defense doing cancer research, and they don't understand the program. So if you could tell us a little bit about that, that would be great.
Yes, I can, Robin, just a little bit. I have reviewed for them a couple times, and I, like you, was thinking Department of Defense. And actually, if you go to their website, they do explain why. I think the main reason is because they are in charge of the, I want to say military, if that's the right term. Men and women in the military also get cancer. So these programs have developed over time, but I know in particular with the breast cancer program, funding was allocated thanks to advocacy efforts by one organization, the National Breast Cancer Coalition, which is the one that does the trainings for us. I know they have a lobbying arm, and they lobbied hard to get these funds allocated. And as you know, every year these funds have to be allocated through Congress. But it is, I think, it was started mainly for the men and women who serve in the military. It's a terrific program, and certainly in the breast cancer mechanism, they want researchers that are submitting proposals. They have various mechanisms, but they really want them to think outside the box. They just don't want, the incremental research. They want sort of really, is this going to have an impact as we move forward? So the Department of Defense funds some very novel research, and recently there's been a sort of uprising, I would say, from metastatic breast cancer patients, and rightly so, because they were feeling that, much of the research focused on primary breast cancer, and yet, we have 40,000 plus women a year and men dying of metastatic breast cancer, of which there is no cure. So there is definitely now more of a focus on advanced disease and how can we, at least make it, we'd like to cure it, but at least if researchers could make it a chronic disease, rather than this devastating disease. Sorry, that's maybe a little bit too broad, Robin, but that's what I know about the DOD.
One thing, let me interject on that, too. The DOD, the research funding is not only in cancer, but they do a lot of other things. They just announced a $6 million appropriation for tubular sclerosis. And, you know, they deal with all kinds of things, brain injuries and people needing prosthetics and things of that nature. So they deal with more than just cancer. It's really quite a massive thing. And just about anybody that has a disease or a condition, if they'll go to the CDMRP website, they'll find out that there are all kinds of opportunities for consumer reviewers to get involved with that program. Okay, Robin, go ahead. Thank you.
Right. The DOD does research on all the things that especially hit hard for servicemen and women and their families. So any kind of condition might be eligible for DOD research, which is really an amazing program. And they do look at things that are different from, for example, the National Institutes of Health research. So it's a very exciting program. Susie, you mentioned turning metastatic breast cancer into a chronic condition instead of a devastating one. And I agree, that's really important. People don't realize for most stage 4 cancers, there is no cure. But it is possible, especially with the wonderful advances we've made in science recently, to have a long and satisfying life despite having stage 4 cancer. And that's really an exciting advance. But one other thing that you mentioned was that men have breast cancer, and you just mentioned that really briefly. Tell us a little bit about the issue of men with breast cancer.
Yes, I don't have the numbers at the top of my head. It is a small percentage, but even so, it is certainly a cancer that they should be aware of. And just like women, you know, who should be aware of their breast health, men should be certainly aware of, you know, their chest health, I guess. And there's certainly research going on, and I think there are several men's support groups nationally that do very good work. So I think I think a lot of the treatments are similar. So there is some crossover, but obviously there are other probably unique issues because of gender differences. And I think, you know, that sort of brings me on to my other passion, is that we do need patients to consider clinical trials, because we're really not going to know exactly until, you know, we do have the research behind so many of these issues. So I suspect at this time there are certainly clinical trials taking place. I think sometimes it's hard for patients to know about clinical trials. They're often not discussed, particularly in a community setting where most patients, you know, do get treatment. But there are some user-friendly websites, and I know even the government website has got a little bit more user-friendly. In breast cancer, I'm actually a patient advisor for breastcancertrials.org, and, you know, we cover every sort of trial related to breast cancer, from observational to treatment, survivorship. It's all on this website, and it's very easy to navigate. So I've done my little piece for clinical trials.
The National Cancer Institute says that there's about 2,550 cases estimated. That was for 2018 in males, and there would be about 480 deaths due to that. And it's mostly in the ductal areas of the breast that it originates in males.
Right.
Joyce,
right.
You got any questions for Susie?
Yes, I noticed on your resume, too, that you've worked with Reach for Recovery. And I think that's a wonderful program, and I certainly benefited from that in the 1970s when I had breast cancer. So you want to tell us about what Reach for Recovery is and what volunteers do?
Yes, so Reach to Recovery is what I would call a peer mentor support program excuse me, for breast cancer patients. And it's probably nearly as old as the American Cancer Society, but it's still a very worthwhile program. It began when women were having radical mastectomies and they had to stay in hospital. And so they would have other volunteers come and what they called have a visit. So they called them Reach to Recovery visits, and these were very powerful to patients so that they could at least, you know, talk to someone who had been sort of in their shoes, because at the time no one really wanted to talk about breast cancer or the very radical treatment that they had at that time. But the program has is still around, and it has grown, and now it is more a phone, you know, talking on the phone, so they call it a phone visit, and even you can have email visits if you want. So a coordinator will call me. I had to have training, of course, on how to, you know, talk to patients, what not to say, you know, how to be a good listener. Many of these skills I picked up when I was doing helpline for the local group. And it really, it's a very rewarding for me, but it's also an eye-opener, because many of the women that I visit or support with the Reach to Recovery have difficult situations. I'm you know, more getting near a senior age, so I tend to be matched with someone who's more my age and had a similar diagnosis. But many of these women are struggling. Maybe they live on their own, or they can't, they don't drive as well, or they don't have the insurance they would like. And so it's very humbling, but again, disconcerting that there's this inequity in the system. And so, you know, I do the best I can. I'm aware of all the local resources, and I live in the San Francisco Bay Area, where we have tremendous resources, both at cancer centers at Stanford and UCSF, but also in the community. We have some fabulous cancer support nonprofit organizations. And so, you know, I can hook up many of these patients with these organizations who give their services for free, but I do see, you know, this concern, especially with the older patients, that, you know, they sometimes don't get all the services they need, or they have other, you know, issues or comorbidities, and I'm just worried that they don't always get the best of care.
So that's one thing that a volunteer can...
Have you seen progress in treatment through the Cancer Navigator program?
I know the American Cancer Society has a Navigator program, but I don't think we have it here in this area. I would love to see a national Navigator program, and that it was a sort of must, you know, for cancer patients, because I do believe that it does help patients, because, as you know, the system is so fragmented and many do get lost. I mean, there was a book written, Lost in Transition, and they do, and they're not sure, because, you know, you're hit with a cancer diagnosis and suddenly, you know, you need to be up to speed on Cancer 101, and you don't sometimes know all the questions, and let alone how to deal with the answers. So I would love that there were more navigators. Some hospitals have them. Some rely on the social workers, but, you know, there's never enough of these people. So I think a navigation would be terrific. More navigation would really be terrific.
you know, as tiny as the area is that I live in, I live in a fairly large county and land area, and we've got about 80,000 people, and we have a very small community hospital that has a nurse navigator program, and every lady that's diagnosed with breast cancer is visited by one of these nurse navigators, and they actually walk them through the process. But these navigators are also involved with almost anyone that gets a cancer diagnosis. Now, let me ask you this, Susie, and I'm going to kind of break us away because we've got about 8 minutes left in the interview here. You're involved in the Athena Breast Health Network and the Wisdom Study. Now, that's a collaboration of what, five university hospital systems in California, and it's looking at recruiting, what, 400,000 people over a period of time that's dealing with breast cancer?
Yes, so the you're correct. Athena is a program of the UC medical system in California. And yes, the Wisdom Study, which is a screening study primarily, is looking to recruit 100,000 women. And these are women that haven't had breast cancer. And the idea of this study, it is funded by PCORI, which, you know, is a great program. And the idea of this study is that so many women are confused with the messages they're getting about breast cancer screening. We're all concerned, you know, are we doing it at the right time and how often? Some women are not even getting a mammography screening, so that's even another issue. So the Wisdom Study is looking to see whether the current annual screening regime compared to a risk-based screening where participants, we are looking at their genes, their biology, such as dense breasts, their family history and lifestyle. So we're seeing if this risk-based screening might be as safe as annual screening. So what that means is that some patients who go into the randomized arm may be offered a genetic test so that we can see if they have high-risk mutations, such as BRCA1 or 2, and some other things that they call SNPs, and then look at their risks, such as, you know, do they have dense breasts? And then they have a special score, and then they can score these women and just say, yes, you have maybe more risk than this woman, so you should maybe get screened annually, but this woman could maybe get screened every 2 years. This study is so desperately needed because at the moment, women are told, four start at 40, start at 50. Some institutions are only doing mammography every 2 years now. Some are saying every annually. So there's just so much confusion out there. So this is a study that has some science and some biology behind it. And if we reach our numbers of 100,000, we're now moving out of California. We have just taken on the University of Chicago. So we're expanding our sites to national sites so that we can get this 100,000 women. This could really be a big breakthrough so that we learn once and for all, you know, when is the best time for each woman to get screened. And this may vary because we're all different.
I'm impressed with the range of activities that you've engaged in, and you're a very wonderful example of what a volunteer can do. You've taken the lemons and made lemonade, so to speak, and really tried to help other people down this journey, because you're in a position to notice things like the scarcity of services for some of the people who are struggling with breast cancer. And so I think that's one of the things that the navigators and the volunteers are able to do with home visits, with lengthier chats with people than the doctors usually have the time to do.
Yes, thank you, Joy. I do feel blessed that I can do this, and this is, I have to put my husband in the picture here, because luckily, you know, he is able to support my activities, and obviously I get a few stipends here and there, but you certainly couldn't make a big career out of this, but the rewards are that you feel that you are helping patients now, patients in the future, especially, you know, in my activities as a research advocate, you know, when I am supporting principal investigators, you know, on a study, and they have some ideas, but it's so good to be able to give the patient perspective. Well, had you thought about this, or what about this? And, you know, certainly in my role on the scientific review committee at Stanford, we review all the clinical trials before they are opened at the cancer center. You know, are patients actually going to want to go on this study? You know, it's just such a big issue that we just, you know, there's always somewhere to get involved. So even if people can't, you know, right, do the breadth of what I'm doing in all the areas of advocacy, there's always an area somewhere where you can be making a difference. It's wide open, and thank goodness for volunteers.
Right, and not only people who have experienced breast cancer themselves, but as you pointed out, women who have not, who may be concerned about it or certainly want to help the community, can enroll in some of these studies. I know that Dr. Susan Love's group is enrolling 1 million women. You have a California study that's enrolling 100,000 women, and these are healthy women with healthy breasts, but trying to help us learn what tiny little factors that may seem insignificant now may be pointing to a risk of breast cancer. Because the earlier we find it, the more successfully it can be treated. And that's the key for everyone.
Absolutely, too. And we talk about, you know, we're very much into precision medicine or personalized medicine. And certainly the wisdom study is, you know, a good example of that. You know, we're going to find out that, you know, not everybody is the same. You know,
right.
You know, we are going to have to be a lot more savvy with patients. And of course, the field is growing by leaps and bounds. But, you know, a lot of these tests and things that are in trial or in development haven't yet got into the clinic. So, and of course, you know, we want everybody to benefit from this. So, but yes, this is a way to give back, is to get involved in these studies. I mean, the wisdom is online. You don't even have to go anywhere other than where you get your mammogram. So it's ideal, and as I say, we're now expanding to other sites in the nation, so it's very exciting.
We'll put the link to the Wisdom Study online. Currently, 19,633 ladies have joined it, so there's room for you, especially in California, to sign up for the Wisdom Program. We will put that link online. Susie, we have had a great time talking to you. Have you got a couple of thoughts you want to leave with us?
I think I want to, again, thank you very much for inviting me. And I want to thank you, too, and Joyce and Robin for all the great work you're doing. And you certainly understand what the issues are that patients are facing. I would just, you know, encourage anyone that really wants to give back to maybe enroll in an observational study or see if they can help with navigation. I mean, so many people, unfortunately, are impacted by cancer. They may be caregivers, family members. Just reach out. There's all sorts of training programs available. And just get involved, because your voice really matters. And we're seeing more and more that the patient is at the center of the circle. And we're hearing words like patient-centric. And it's very important that the patient voice is heard and but also that of the families and the caregivers. I just appreciate the opportunity to be able to share this information.
Well, thank you. Yes, patient voice really matters. Robin, final thoughts?
I thought Susie summed it up beautifully.
Absolutely. Joyce, final thoughts?
Great. Thanks so much, Susie. And yes, I encourage everyone to get involved. I know after my own breast cancer, my sister joined the sister study. There's a study of women whose sisters have had breast cancer, again, to try to determine whether being a sister of someone is a risk factor that you should be conscious of. And so far, no results from that. But those are the kinds of things that are extremely powerful. If we can get 100,000 or a million women and men to join in these studies and try to help us understand how better to find them early and treat them successfully. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Susie, we enjoyed talking to you. We'll get the links to the Wisdom Study out there, and I'm going to have Joyce to add that photo that you had taken of you and I in New Orleans on the website also. Thank you very much for listening to this edition of The Powerful Patient. Join us again the next time as Robin and Joyce and I just have a blast talking to somebody on The Powerful Patient.
You deserve fulfillment. You deserve opportunity. You deserve excellence. Encore Boston Harbor is hiring, and we have every kind of job for one kind of person. Exceptional. Click here to learn more. You deserve an encore.
Space. Some regions are vast and empty, other areas we call closets. Fortunately, Kevin from the Container Store has answers.
Right.
Kevin, what gives you the power over space?
I'd say Elfa customizable closets. With free design and Elfa's adjustable shelving and drawers, I can create space in any size closet.
Kevin, master of space and closets.
Or just Kevin. Plus, right now, save 30% on Elfa and installation and earn up to $500 in credit through February 10th.
At the Container Store, where space comes from.
Where is that music coming from?